Французский национальный фронт, бельгийский фламандский интерес, итальянская Лига Севера,
французская ультраправая партия Национальный фронт, которую возглавляет правопопулистская немецкая партия. Марин Ле Пен
in France to Norbert Hofer in Austria, from the Lega Nord in Italy to the AfD in Germany. It's no secret that Vladimir Putin's Russia has been aiding, abetting, and in some cases financing far-right parties and movements in the West. But what's behind the Kremlin's dark dance with Europe's extremists and xenophobes? What's in it for each side, and where is it leading? Today we'll be discussing an important new book that addresses these questions. Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me here in the studio is co-host Mark Galeotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, head of its Center for European Security, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Hi there, Brian.
And joining us via Skype from London is Anton Shekhovtsov, a visiting fellow at the Institute for Human Sciences in Vienna and author of the newly published book, Russia in the Western Far Right, Tango Noir. Welcome back to the podcast, Anton, and congratulations on a great book.
Thank you, Brian, and hi, Mark.
Hi there.
So, Anton, to say your book was long awaited and extremely timely would be a bit of an understatement. And having read it, I have to say I wasn't disappointed. I wanted to start off with your main thesis. You write at the very outset that each side in this relationship is driven by, quote, circumstantial and pragmatic considerations, specifically attaining domestic or international legitimacy and reshaping hostile domestic and international environments. This is to suggest this is not an alliance of values, but more of a pragmatic alliance of interests. Would that be correct? And can you elaborate on that a bit?
Yes, that would be correct. From 2004, 2005, when Putin's regime started to move in this quite extreme anti-American and anti-Western direction because of the color revolutions in the post-Soviet space. In Georgia and Ukraine and Kyrgyzstan, they felt threatened. Putin's regime felt threatened. I think it was a virtual threat of a color revolution in Russia itself. But it felt that they lacked legitimacy, external legitimacy. So they started looking for new allies. They would still be interested in cooperating with mainstream actors in the West, but increasingly they started turning their attention to the far right. And that was initially, that was in order to restore legitimacy, especially for the domestic audience in Russia, to show that Russia is not isolated, that they do have allies in the West, but those allies would be these so-called patriotic movements and parties. So this is one pragmatic consideration, to restore legitimacy. But on the other hand, my thesis is that far-right parties, they're not just, you know, foolish tools of Putin's regime. They have agency. And partly their pro-Russian effort, their cooperation with various Russian actors is driven by also domestic interests in their home countries. It's not only to engage with Russian speakers in their own countries and try to convince them to support these far-right parties, but also to show to domestic audiences that their far-right ideology is not marginal, it's not longer the fringe, because they could point to Russia and say, well, Russia is driven by the same ideology, and Russia is a great power, so we have a powerful ally. And again, that would somehow boost their legitimacy for the domestic audience. But there is also this international side. In the case of Russia, it does try to influence European and Western politics in general by providing political and media support for the far right. So the international image of Russia would be better in the eyes of Western audiences. I think it's a very wrong strategy or tactics, but still Putin's Putin's regime believes that by influencing European politics, they can also attain or restore this international legitimacy of the regime.
Now, you don't see any ideological component to this at all? Is there any kind of meeting of values, meeting of the minds here? Is it all just naked pragmatism, or is there something more to it?
Yeah, there is this ideological sign. European far-right parties, most of them, they are socially conservative, they are for law and order, they are authoritarian, and also Russia can be described in these terms. It is socially conservative. At least the regime tries to position itself as socially conservative. Of course, it's not conservative. The ruling elite, they lead a very happy life and enjoy all the vices of the West. But it does position itself as a conservative force, as an avant-garde of European conservatism, which is, again, wrong, but still. And also, it's authoritarian, it is anti-American, and most far-right parties, despite Donald Trump, are still quite anti-American, and by anti-American, they mean first and foremost rejection of liberal democracy. So there is an overlap, ideological overlap, because between the majority of far-right parties in the West and Russia.
Now, another thing that really struck me in the book is how you describe how this phenomenon just didn't pop out of thin air in the Putin years. It evolved over time, and how relationships that long predated the Putin era were essentially upgraded and institutionalized by Putin in recent years. You noted, for example, how I didn't realize this, the post-World War II USSR collaborated with far-right parties in Europe for intelligence gathering purposes. You looked closely at the relationship between the so-called Red-Brown Coalition, the opposition to Boris Yeltsin, the nationalist-communist opposition to Boris Yeltsin, and the European far-right in the 1990s. You looked at Alexander Dugin's ties to Spanish neo-Nazis, Zhirinovsky's contacts with Le Pen and the German People's Union, Sergei Glazyev and Lyndon LaRouche and all of this. And then you noted how after the Orange Revolution, the ideas of the Red-Brown Coalition became steadily mainstreamed. And finally, you showed how this evolved into Putin's embrace of conservatism and traditional values, at least verbally, after 2012. What's your main takeaway from this evolution? Because go ahead.
Well, what you described reflects my research, because I was working on the book around 3 years, and I started first with what is happening now. Then I tried to go back a bit in time to understand what was the basis of the of today's cooperation. And I went back to the 90s, but then I realized that I would not be able to explain the 90s without explaining the Cold War and even the interwar period. So I went back to history to find the roots of this cooperation. Uh-huh. But yes, indeed, there was a cooperation even during the Cold War. Then there was this opening of Russia to the Western far right in the 90s after the collapse of the Soviet Empire. And what is interesting is that all those contacts in the 90s and up until the end of the first presidential term of Vladimir Putin, those contacts were quite marginal. People who, from the Russian side, the actors who were involved in this cooperation, they did not have any chance to get into power. Dugin, Glazyev, even Zhirinovsky, who was quite popular, especially in the 90s. I mean, they had no chance to get into power. And, but Zhirinovsky was the very first one, among the major politicians in Russia, who suggested that Russia could influence European politics through the far-right parties in the West. He said that in 2003. Putin's regime was not interested at that time. But again, after the series of color revolutions, when Putin thought that Russia was under attack from the West, they changed their position very gradually. I mean, the ruling elites would still not look at the far right as their allies in the West in 2006 or 2007, but gradually with the development of international media, Russian international media, with the electoral monitoring of various legitimate elections, they started noticing that they are, that the far right is a real ally, and they would most likely be supportive of Russia's aggressive in international politics and repressive regime in Russia itself. So gradually that developed, and the next turning point was the protests in Russia in 2011-2012, mm-hmm. the Arab Spring, that again was considered as a color revolution in the Middle East and Northern Africa. So Putin's regime became more and more paranoid, and they started cooperating with the far right on a very new and quite a significant level.
And there was this white paper that was put out by a pro-Kremlin think tank back in 2012, kind of outlining this policy, saying it was that Russia could forge this kind of conservative international. If you remember this paper, I remember writing about it at the time as kind of a curiosity. I didn't yet realize it was actually a blueprint. Mark, let's bring you in here. What struck you about this book?
Yes, well, I mean, first of all, let me also say that I think it's a truly excellent work, really sort of solidly grounded, and I think it's very much needed, not least because it means we'll get away from everyone always defaulting to Marine Le Pen as the example right. that they use time and time again. So they have a lot more sort of to go on. Yeah, I mean, I think a few points that I would want to raise. I mean, one is I think it's fascinating the discussion about right-wing movements' perceptions of Russia. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that I'd like to go back and get Anton to talk a little bit more about. And what that says about, in a way, the capacity of individuals and movements to actually kid themselves and find what they may be looking for. Because although this is obviously, yes, to a large extent, a very pragmatic relationship, it is rooted also in some sense of believing that they've found some kind of kinship there. Secondly, I mean, I was very struck by, and for those of you who buy and read the book, as you all should, it's at the end of chapter 6, this sort of six-stage sort of schema for actually how the Russians seek to build their connections with these various right-wing movements, because particularly from my point of view, because it very much connects to what I have been seeing separately in my recent ECFR paper about the use that the Russians make of sort of deniable non-state, semi-state, para-state sort of actors and curators, like sort of, you know, thinkers like, well, I use that term in the broadest possible sense, Dugin, demigarchs like Malofeyev and all kinds of other movements as these sort of arms of state connectivity. So again, I think it's really interesting to come out. But what I really wanted to drill down to particularly is the issue of impact. Anton made the point earlier about the extent to which, in part, this is the Russians' quest for legitimacy at home. And I think we see that. We see that, for example, and this is not in any way a far-right example, but you know, here in the Czech Republic, a lot of concern about President Zeman's statements in favour of Russia. Well, it's not actually as if it affects policy here in the Czech Republic. It's that it then gets recirculated within Russian media. Mm-hmm. See, the president of a NATO and EU country believes this. Well, likewise, again, it doesn't really matter how minuscule and how disagreeable these movements may be. It's how they can be spun, both mm-hmm. at home and also in other international markets, which is one of the sort of the key elements. And that kind of therefore brings me to the sort of point of something I think that comes out well from the book is what actually has been the impact. We can see lots of stuff happening, all kinds of interactions and wooings and seductions and alliances and mm-hmm. transactions. But if one looks at the big picture, okay, how far has this really advanced Russian policy? And I think that's much more of an open question. Clearly, it's just simply one small piece in an overall.
Well, yeah, I would argue you have to look at all this as part of an ecosystem. Just like you can't look at the disinformation in isolation, you can't look at the active measures in isolation, you can't look at the support for the far right in the isolation. It creates this.
Well, it's true enough, but again, I mean, I think it does raise the question, though. I mean, yes, that's true, but the danger is that therefore becomes an answer to not try and think about any of the components at all. This very specific one, particularly given that the Russians often are also cultivating extreme left movements, you know, particularly in countries like Greece and Italy. Mm-hmm. You very clearly have, you know, in Italy you've got Lega Nord and Cinque Stelle,
right?
Both the recipients of praise and airtime and so forth from the Russians. I think for me one of the fascinating things would be to try and unpick how far getting to bed with a whole variety of deeply disreputable sort of actors across Europe. How far is that really advancing the Russians' cause? Or how far do they just simply feel they are? Because it does exactly, it leads to lots of stuff happening and meetings and statements and things.
Anton, what do you think? Mark's kind of brought up a lot to chew on here. I too was fascinated by the section on the image of Russia in the European far-right circles. But I think the terms of what comes out of this, I think, is an interesting issue to raise now.
Yeah, well, going back to Mark's first point, essentially, the image of Russia as a potential ally of the far right, of the Western far right, was born already in the 1930s. In the National Socialist circles, there was this movement, National Bolshevik Movement, that perceived Russia as an ally of National Socialist Germany in its fight against France and Britain. So Russia would be considered, and they looked at National Bolsheviks, looked like at Russia as a brotherly proletarian nation that was opposing the Western imperialist order that was at that time manifested through politics of Britain and France. And after the Second World War, this, you know, Britain and France were replaced by the U.S. as the enemy. And again, if you're looking for an ally in Europe or in Eurasia, then Russia would be that ally. And this is how Russia was perceived in many far-right circles.
So a communist regime.
Even if the Soviet Union was communist and the far right rejected communism as such, I mean, they could be termed as anti-communist movements. But still, geopolitically, some of them would ally with Russia against American influence in Europe, what they believed was the American influence in Europe. So it was strategic in a sense, but, at the same time, there were far-right activists like Francis Parker Yorkie, the American fascist, who was nevertheless quite anti-American. He believed that after the beginning of anti-Semitic policies of Stalin, that Soviet Union could be also an ideological ally. Uh-huh. Because he believed that Bolshevism was finally getting rid of internationalism and started to look like Third Reich.
Well, there's some truth to that, actually. Stalin's debate with Trotsky was all about that, although they didn't call it that.
Yeah, and then the Belgian fascist Jean Thiriard, one of the most interesting figures in the international pan-European far-right circles during the Cold War, he embraced the Soviet Union, and he was even talking about Soviet Europe from Vladivostok to Dublin. And that would be his vision of Euro-Soviet Empire, partly fascist, partly Soviet, so this very bizarre mixture, ideological mixture. So despite communism, there was this Russophile, even pro-Soviet positions of the far right.
But what's interesting is that a lot of this is very, very much rooted in racial ethnopolitics. And yes, if you look at European far-right movements, they're pretty much invariably racist xenophobes, which is interesting because, again, they look to Russia as a sort of, you know, a land in which the white man can be a white man, We also see this in sort of American far-right circles. But actually, when one looks at Russia, it is a country with, you know, very high levels of non-white population, in which actually the Kremlin has been hostile to the notions of anti-Semitism, is very careful about racial politics, you know, incidents like the Biryulyeva race riots, definitely things that the Kremlin wants to avoid. Again, I find it fascinating the extent to which actually they are thinking about a kind of Russia that maybe once existed, but nowadays isn't that. It's they are choosing to invent a Russia for themselves.
Well, I think on one hand, you're right. But on the other hand, the Kremlin does play with these ideas.
Of course,
and sometimes they get out of hand. But Anton, go ahead.
I would add here, especially in the case of France, there is a very long tradition of looking at Russia as a European partner, and there are a lot of sentiments, very positive sentiments in the French society towards Russia. They're romanticizing Russia, which other societies do in Europe. For some of the French people, it's the idea of Russia is a heavenly Russia, you know, very close, very religious. So they have this very conservative at the same time. And some Russian actors, some Russian thinkers or activists, they would like to present Russia as the real Europe, as the Europe of the 19th century. And which is non-multicultural, non-liberal, very conservative, you know, the symphony of the powers that Russia contributed to in the 19th century. So, yeah, Russia is playing with this image and is trying to boost it, you know, to juxtapose the so-called gay Europa. The Europe of liberal democratic values and LGBT rights, all these things, and very conservative Russia, which is the real Europe, the Europe that still sticks to conservative values and the traditions of old.
Now there's Russia and there's Putin, and it's another thing that's interesting to me is what about Putin the man is so attractive to these parties and movements. You know, I mean, Peter Pomerantsev, in a quote I never, ever, ever tire of repeating, famously said Putin's turned himself into the Che Guevara of the xenophobic far right. I mean, is there something to that, Anton? Is there something about Putin the man that has kind of kicked this thing up another level?
Yes, and I think one of the first pro-Putin narratives that developed in the far right circles in the West was how Putin efficiently dealt with the oligarchs. And oligarchs for the far right is the symbol of it's a sort of covert anti-Semitism when they're talking about, you know, the world finances and financial capital and oligarchs. It's sort of covert anti-Semitic sentiment.
So they're willfully disregarding reality, then, in that case, because
absolutely. I mean, they're romanticizing Russia. I mean, they don't travel. Well, some of them do travel, but still, they would only go to Moscow or St. Petersburg. They would not go to smaller towns and cities and see how life is out there. So they are romanticizing Russia, and of course, they believe that Putin got rid of all the oligarchs, and they would not know, probably, or would not want to know that there is a new oligarchy that replaced the old oligarchy of during the Yeltsin's time. So yeah, that was the first pro-Putin sentiment that developed, and then of course they like that Putin is bold, that he is sort of challenging the position of the U.S. in the world, so they have huge respect towards him. Mm-hmm.
Now, I wanted to actually, because Mark raised another issue that I also think is definitely worth exploring, and that is this typology of organizations and progression through this that Russia uses, the typology you drew out, I believe it was the end of the sixth chapter, and also how to get Mark in here and how this kind of fits into your concept of active measures. You kind of touched on that, but I'd like to explore that a little bit deeply if we could.
Yes, so the typology, I call this, you know, I call these organizations and individuals operators of all these relations. So I would, you could start with two types. Firstly, these are Russophile activists within far-right parties. You can see them in France, you can see them in Italy, in Belgium, in some other countries. These are people who started their pro-Russian effort, basically even without Russia's involvement first. So they wanted to be close to Russia or do something good for Russia. Then you have Russian activists, activist operators. These are Russian ultranationalists who were in contact with the European or Western far-right parties, and they started to engage with them increasingly. But still, this is a very marginal level. You know, ultranationalists from both sides. It doesn't lead anywhere. But then you have Russian soft power operators that started to work with far-right activists in the West who were willing to cooperate with the Russian institutions and Russian organizations. So they helped establish or helped develop these contacts. Then, of course, you have ultra-conservative operators from the Russian side, people like Alexei Komov, who is one of the main actors in the this international, very much homophobic and conservative scene. He is the representative of World Congress of Families, and he works or he cooperates with Konstantin Malofeyev, Russian Orthodox oligarch, who had enough money to sometimes, I think, even invest in developing of these relations. Then you have diplomatic operators. These are embassies and consulates, in Russian embassies and consulates, who also contributed to the building of these relations. Who would invite far-right activists and far-right politicians to embassies and consulates and, you know, talk to them, explain Russian position, the position of Putin's regime towards the West and towards their own country, and then they would repeat these narratives in the media or during their campaigning. And then, of course, you have in the recent years Russian power operators. The chairman of State Duma at that time, Sergei Naryshkin, now he has a different position, but he met with some of the far-right politicians. Then you have Alexei Pushkov, who was dealing with the international affairs in the parliament, and then you have all these people from the United Russia Party who signed cooperation coordination agreements with the Italian far right Northern League, or with the Austrian Freedom Party. So these contacts and these typology, it also show how these contacts develop. From the fringe circles, when ultra-nationalists from Russia and Europe would talk to each other, and up to functionaries of the ruling party in Russia, the United Russia, and functionaries of the State Duma, of the parliament.
So yeah, what strikes me here, each level you've outlined here, Anton, gets closer and closer to power, essentially. Now, Mark, you noted how this kind of fits into the general concept in your ECFR paper on Russian active measures. What specifically do you draw?
Well, I think it's particularly an example of the Russian capacity to basically operate in a whole series of different vectors. You know, we have a mix of what are clearly top-down initiatives, which are actually sort of made in Moscow directly, and then a lot of bottom-up initiatives in which individual actors, which precisely, I mean, doesn't have to be freelancers. I mean, exactly, it can be an ambassador, a consul, a second secretary political, or indeed, you know, station chief of intelligence service, actually are also carrying out their own acts that they think will further the wider agenda.
Ad hocism.
Precisely. And so, and this, first of all, it allows far denser connectivities than you would have if it was just if there was just a kind of, you know, a Russian foreign ministry department dealing with barking nationalists. You know, then you would actually have a single plan and a schema and one person who's responsible and so forth. And maybe, yes, resources could be funneled into through that. But nonetheless, it would be essentially sort of narrow. This way, you actually have a whole broad range of different types of contacts, which
it's
is
almost
that much
like
harder.
The Soviet concept of interlocking directorates, if you remember back from our Soviet studies days, I mean, to a degree.
But more, this is, I think, but again, I think this is, in some ways, actually, if I was going to draw a parallel, this is with the whole revisionist debate about Stalinism, how far it was terror from above and terror from below. Mm. I mean, this is active measures from above and active measures from below. And so, again, I think this is the issue. And this is one reason, again, to go back to a little bit of unsolicited praise, why this book is so valuable. It's precisely because it pulls together so many great examples of the whole variety of different ways. Now, when they actually do make those connections, the thing that struck me was, yes, I can see all the transactional values, what each side gets out of it. But I think also we shouldn't be blind to the power of ego, the extent to which actually one of the Russians' greatest assets is precisely that they seem to be taking these people seriously. These people who are essentially sort of marginal weirdos who have very little chance in most cases, thank God, of attaining significant power. But nonetheless, exactly, they are invited to the ambassador's reception and given Ferrero Rocher or whatever. They are invited onto TV, whether it's even if it's RT or whatever. And I think this is one of the particular advantages the Russians have got, precisely because they have such a de-ideologized program. They can deal with anyone. They can flatter anyone. They can make anyone feel they're important, precisely because there is no real platform. I mean, in many ways, if one looks at the Putinist state, it is in some ways reminiscent of Italian-style fascism. Mm. Certainly sort of Putin as the sort of the Vojt / Duce, in my opinion. But when it comes down to it, I mean, they can find ways of playing to every single audience. Exactly, whether it's the bulwark of European resistance to American unipolarity or whatever. So I think, again, it's this extraordinary flexibility that is created by this diffuse individual initiative-based program that I think really comes out. And last point I'd make is, again, precisely these are not on the whole parties that are likely to attain power. And ironically enough, if they did attain power, probably the process of doing so and quite possibly the compromises they would have to make would actually make them that much less useful to the Kremlin. And again, I think what really this comes down to is that the primary expectation and goal of the Kremlin is not that they can use these to have quisling regimes in European countries. It's rather it is precisely to create division, create the sort of internal dissent, the kind of rhetorically and sometimes physically violent kind of politics, which actually in a way neutralize Europe. And in that respect, I think that the far right is actually rather more useful than, I would say, the far left at the moment.
Mm. Yeah, there's a good book to be written on the far left. This Mark, that opens up to exactly where I wanted to segue before we move to the second half, and that is this ecosystem I was talking about earlier. Antoine, you had a couple of great chapters on how the far right is used in very specific areas like election monitoring or in international media or in party-to-party contacts with international parliamentarism. And this, I mean, when I was looking at this, I was thinking of this large ecosystem of Russia's non-kinetic, what I've come to call Russia's non-kinetic war with the West, what Mark calls the political war with the West. One of my hobby horses is like let's stop fetishizing just the information and let's look at this whole ecosystem. And I thought these chapters brought a lot of that together. And I was wondering if you could talk a bit about how Russia uses the far right in election monitoring, for example, how Russia uses the far right in international media and in international parliamentarism. If you can go into that a bit, would be good.
I do find these spheres, election monitoring and media, much more important, in fact, that this 9 million loan to the National Front in 2014. Why I think that these are more important areas because These are institutionalized forms of cooperation. They have managed to create something new. So again, going back to 2003, 2005, this period of color revolutions in post-Soviet space, and Putin's regime looked at those revolutions, especially the Ukrainian, the Orange Revolution, and they saw that NGOs and electoral monitoring organizations played a very important role in mobilizing the society against the stolen elections. And there started to appear various initiatives in Russia itself, initiatives aimed at creating other GONGOs, these government-organized, non-government organizations, or parallel structures or alternative structures of electoral monitoring. So the idea was that you have to somehow legitimize some of the elections or referendum in post-Soviet space where one of the contenders or one of the parties would be pro-Russian or pro-Putin. So, for example, you need an election in one of the unrecognized states, such as Transnistria or Abkhazia. Russia is interested in those conflicts and in those frozen conflicts and to somehow influence Georgia or Moldova. So you need an election there. And that would be illegitimate, completely illegitimate. But for the Russian audience, they have to look legitimate. So they would send electoral monitoring organizations with the electoral monitors. And they would monitor these elections and, prove, in quotation marks, that they were legitimate. And the international electoral monitors would be far-right activists. Mm-hmm. That developed from 2005, 2006 on. And what we saw, for example, in Crimea and the so-called referendum in March 2014, those were people who already, at least on the organizational level, the organizations that were involved in monitoring that referendum, they emerged already almost 10 years before that. So that was just the tip of the iceberg of this huge business. And this is business.
And we're talking about the CIS electromonitoring organization here is what we're talking about.
Yeah. Yes, that was the first organization, Russian organization, that started to engage with far-right activists who would be posing as electoral monitors. But then it was replaced in 2011, 2012, as the main coordinator. It was replaced by the Civic Control Association, which is based in Moscow. There are very interesting developments in the scene. But talking about the second area, which is also an institutionalized form of cooperation with the far right, is the media. And I would give you an example here. 2008, August, the war with Georgia, and it was 5 days war, very quick, quite efficient, despite some problems with the military operations on the Russian side. But what they realized, and there was even a panic, in the Russian media and expert circles in autumn 2008, that Russia lost the information warfare with the West. The Russian media looked at the media in the West and they were shocked because they couldn't really find any significant politicians or officials in the West who would justify Russia's actions in Georgia. And then it's very interesting to look at that period because some Russian media would look at the comment sections on the internet website, and they would be quoting some anonymous bloggers from Spain who justified this invasion. So they were desperate. They were honestly desperate for some Western support for Russia's actions. And then in autumn 2008, the Freedom Party of Austria, the far-right party in Austria, had a conference which was devoted to Georgia. And the leader of that party, Heinz-Christian Strache, he said that Saakashvili was a dictator and Russia's actions were completely legitimate and justified. And that was the entrance for him in the Russian media. They would quote him in several papers. So finally, we have this Western guy, a leader of the party, who is in favor of Russian foreign policies. So this is how it started. They, and especially when Russia Today was reorganized into RT, they realized that they have to boost the information warfare. And so they went essentially from the narrative Russia is good to the combination of two narratives, Russia is good and the West is bad. And they also realized that they would not be able to find some significant or authoritative politicians in the West who would be corroborating the narrative the West is bad. But they found the allies in promoting of this narrative within isolationist, conspiracy theorists, far right, far left, in these circles. And this was the entrance of the far right into the Russian international media, which is, and this element is still very much significant, and it is evolving even now.
Mm. No, and the word that keeps coming back to me as you were speaking is legitimization, because we talked about who would take the CIS, EMO, or the Civic Control Organization seriously. But when this is presented, these election monitors are presented, when they had X amount of Europeans in this, and it gives it this air of legitimacy. Ditto for the international media. They put a bunch of crackpots, quite frankly, on the air and identify them as political analysts or European politicians. I love the generic labels that commentators get on RT. You don't get anything really specific.
Yeah, I give one example with the RT when they presented in 2012-2013 Richard Spencer, the notorious American neo-Nazi, as an expert on Syria.
Right.
It was Libya, you know, something like this. They would just say expert. Or if they present somebody, the electoral monitoring organization, they would have people who would be MEPs, you know, members of the European Parliament. Nick Griffin, the former leader of the fascist British National Party, he was an MEP. So they would just say, well, it was endorsed by the member of the European Parliament. So what's your problem?
Right. Mark, anything to add before we shift gears? All right, and that's a good segue into the second half. In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and move from Russia's support for the far right abroad to Russia's problem with the far right at home and look at the growing assertiveness of the far right Orthodox Christian activists inside Russia itself. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me here in the studio is co-host Mark Galeotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, head of its Center for European Security, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And joining us via Skype from London is Anton Shekhovtsov, a visiting fellow at the Institute for Human Sciences in Vienna, and author of the newly published and long-awaited book, Russia and the Western Far Right, Tango Noir. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rferl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Фильм является высокопровокативным.
И вот это оскорбление оскорбляет людей.
Я не снимал фильм, связанный с религиозной тематикой.
Фильм «Матильда».
Фильм «Матильда».
«Матильда».
Массовые протесты, горящие автомобили и кино.
Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov says the police should crack down on them. Culture minister Vladimir Medinsky calls them sectarian arsonists. And the newspaper Vedomosti has asked why Patriarch Kirill has been silent about them. The growing extremism of Orthodox Christian activists, most notably the threats from a group ominously calling itself Christian State, against theaters showing the controversial film Matilda, was entirely predictable. Since Vladimir Putin returned to the Kremlin, the regime has encouraged, manipulated, and utilized the most nationalist, xenophobic, and nativist elements in society for political gain. It's just a matter of time before some of them went rogue. Mark, what do you make of this Christian State phenomenon that we've been hearing so much about this past week in Russia? A classic case of blowback, a bit of dramaturgy before the elections, a little of both?
Yeah, I would say that it is, in fact, a deliciously ironic case of blowback rather than dramaturgia. I mean, this temptation, obviously, with Russia, there's always a temptation to think, but what's really going on?
I tend to agree with you on that, although I think the Kremlin's going to use this.
Of course, they are going to use it. But no, I mean, actually, if one looks at the actors concerned, I mean, it's actually figures who are loose cannon rather than kind of clearly identifiable sort of.
Yeah.
I mean, particularly if one looks at, for example, Natalia Poklonskaya, MP, the former Crimean prosecutor, who's clearly one of the sort of the public voices of this whole sort of bizarre campaign against the film Matilda, that dares to prove that Nicholas II was human rather than the saint that they want him to be. But I think it reflects several things. One is, this is a cynical regime that I think has trouble realizing that some people actually believe things. And therefore they are periodically caught flat-footed when actually people act by their belief in both positive as well as in this case, negative ways.
To hear Medinsky accusing somebody of being sectarian, what did he call
arsonists.
Them? Arsonists.
Exactly. And what does it take to get Medinsky on the right side of the battle lines? this is indeed surreal. But also, the very fact that we have the Russian Orthodox Church hierarchy is currently kind of hiding.
Right,
because they don't want to come out against the sort of this more extreme element of their own base, but conversely, they certainly don't want to be seen to be encouraging it, given that the Kremlin has clearly sort of signaled that it's not a good thing.
And there's been violence. You had a Molotov cocktail attack on the Alexei Uchitel's studio in St. Petersburg. You had two cars burned near his attorney's office in Moscow. With written "Burn Matilda" on it, so this is getting actually physically violent, right? Now.
Yeah, absolutely. I mentioned the sort of Biryuliva race riots earlier. You know, we have periodically seen these explosions of this particularly sort of unpleasant undercurrent that exactly the Kremlin has sought to use when it's convenient, but then every now and then realize that it's not. And
call that their Frankenstein monster.
Interesting thing is, we're coming up to presidential elections in which one of the key problems for the Kremlin will be mobilizing its base, getting people to actually care. It's one thing you can bus your conscripts and your factory employees to the polling stations, but you know, to get the kind of turnout that they clearly want, they actually have to generate some kind of enthusiasm. Mm-hmm. And the problem is at the moment that the enthusiasms that are being generated are actually all rather problematic. They're either Navalny and his anti-corruption campaign that is creeping closer and closer to Putin,
right,
in his most recent video, or else this. And the thing is, Putin now finds himself in a difficult position.
Or let me interject for a minute. Does it, as I suggested in this morning's Daily Vertical, does it give Putin an opportunity to say, I am the responsible, measured, reasonable voice here, and you have, look at all these extremists. You got Navalny and you got this Christian state. He could lump them all together and present himself as the safe alternative.
True, but I mean, and he's done that in the past. I mean, in some ways, one can look at the backlash when he basically ditched the Novorossiya notion and Strelkov was pulled out of the Donbass and so forth. Now, but those people didn't really matter because it was a particular kind of fraction of, shall I say, the sort of muscular nationalist, whatever. But this, precisely because it taps into the church, I mean, I think that actually gives it a different dimension. And does Putin really want to do that? Putin is very risk averse. I mean, the very fact that so far he said nothing.
Right.
You know, as usual,
and
whenever it's something
tricky. To my knowledge, Kirill has not said it. Patriarch Kirill has not said it.
Exactly. As usual, when it's something tricky, he hides behind the hierarchy and his underlings. Well, that's fine for a while. But again, that will become more and more noticeable.
Mm-hmm.
When people ask, well, where's Kirill?
Well, they are. Vyedomosti did a headline this week.
But when they do that, in some ways, that is actually a code for also, where's Putin?
Where's Putin, yeah.
In other words, it's saying, where are the people who precisely ought to be leading opinion?
And people are using, obviously, a group called Christian State, with its overtones to Islamic State, are using the T word, not surprisingly. Echo Moskvy published a series of blogs where they printed scanned versions of the actual letters, the threatening letters. These videos the Christian State have been putting out are eerily reminiscent of IS videos. So this is an explosive cocktail, although I do think Putin's going to use this to his advantage.
He's certainly going to try to. Or Putin's people. I mean, they're obviously going to try to. And again, what they'll probably rely on is trying to segment the appeal. Mm. So in other words, to the church, it'll be a case of, what this was wrong because it went outside the usual channels.
Right.
We absolutely feel your pain, Matilda, disgraceful film, etc. But just there are different ways of doing it. Whereas to the more liberal metropolitan audience, it'll be, we dealt with these lunatics, and exactly, you need an adult at the helm, and there is only one adult, and that is Vladimir Putin. They will obviously try and do that. I mean, of course, what politician does not try and take advantage of whatever opportunity comes their way? But again, I think it says something about the fact that it is coming from what hitherto we would regard as the absolute core of the genuinely Putinist base. Not even just people who just go along with it because it's convenient and easy and they don't see an alternative, but people who genuinely
believe the hype. Yeah.
People who believe that Putin was sent by God to save Russia.
Right.
These are the people who are burning cars now because they don't feel they can get what they need from the state.
Anton, you are our expert on extremists. What's your take on this mess?
What you said, I would agree almost with everything. I would just point out, well, actually, there is now a joke about Natalia Poklonska. As you mentioned, she was a prosecutor in Crimea before the annexation. And the joke is that she is, in fact, a Ukrainian agent undercover that is trying to undermine Russian society by polarizing it and developing these ultra-Orthodox, ultra-Christian, ultra-nationalist ideas. But talking about this seriously, I would completely agree that Putin is trying to... He is already using the situation. I think that would be about comparing Putin and his alleged responsibility and sectarian violence. So he would be the adult in the state. And that happened before. If you remember in 2014, the Russian TV talk shows, they would invite completely mad people like Alexander Dugin or Alexander Prokhanov. But for the same reason, the media would show that these are real extremists. And then Putin would, in this context, would be a moderate.
Initially, people like Prokhanov and Dugin were used by the state. They were mainstreaming these ideas in the early stages of the Ukraine conflict. Then they slowly distanced themselves from them later on, right?
Yeah, but they would be using them in order to show to the society that Putin is actually a moderate, But you would need an example of real extremists. To prove that Putin is a moderate guy. What you probably did not mention during your discussion about these developments is that these protests and Poklonska's position, they were given media visibility. If the Russian state or the regime does not want the society to talk about something, or the society as such, not just some Facebook population or VK population, but they try to conceal, they try to hide that something is happening in the country. In this case, it was completely different. It was given media visibility. And Medinsky is not, it wasn't just to calm down the crowd or calm down anybody. I think it is part of the game that was started by genuine believers, as you correctly say. But it's now part of Putin's game.
So you see some dramaturgy here then, unlike Mark.
That came in later in the process, in the development. Now they're giving this visibility. They are creating a controlled conflict in the society. And I think this is how it's going to be used. If you remember the Pussy Riot case, when they used this completely insignificant insignificant action of the right and made it into a real conflict with the society. Well, partly to somehow undermine the opposition to Putin on the grounds of religious beliefs, but still. Pussy Riot was not obviously an agent of Putin's regime, but it was used, this conflict was used in order to consolidate the regime and to weaken the opposition.
It's actually very interesting because the beginning of this right-wing turn by Putin, the Pussy Riot case was really one of the bookmarks of this, one of the bookends of this.
But I think there's also little evidence that actually the Kremlin was behind it. I mean, it seems to have been that basically the political elite and certainly the prosecutorial services were actually inclined to treat this fairly sort of in a very limited way.
Polonskaya was having the prosecutors blowing her off.
With Pussy Riot, exactly. I mean, and it was actually, it was the Russian Orthodox Church just right. This is our pound of flesh. Again, I think we need to be aware that this is not necessarily a sort of...
I'm not saying cause and effect, but I'm saying, but these are book.
No, exactly. But I think likewise, I think I'm not necessarily seeing that there is actually some kind of line that is being pushed about publicising. I think it's more that, I mean, we know that there is obviously sort of a whole kind of covert media management structure, Peskov and his weekly meetings with editors, right. The Temniki, the little kind of briefing notes that are sent. I think at the moment it's more that I don't think anyone knows what kind of a line to take with this. Do you actually try and strangle this movement by precisely denying it publicity? But given that the church still hasn't really sort of identified its position and this is actually in a way making the state their enemy. At the moment, after all, these groups, they are taking direct action, which is obviously implicitly subversive, but they are not saying we're doing this because Putin is a wimp.
Right.
I think that the moment...
If they wanted to shut it down, though, they could shut this down.
Well, I mean, look, of course, if this had been some kind of anti-Kremlin movement doors would be being kicked down, people would already be up on terrorism charges and such like. Of course, if they want to do that. But again, I think they're not yet sure what the hell they do with this movement.
I mean, a lot will be, a big tell will be what happens with Pokolonskaya. Because she, if you remember the early days after the Crimean annexation, she was showcased. She was one of the superstars coming out of Crimea. Now she's in the parliament. And you're starting to see some elements of the regime wanting to distance themselves from her because she's a bit of an embarrassment. She's very glamorous and telegenic, but she's also a bit of an embarrassment. And so I'm kind of keeping an eye on what happens with her.
Mm-hmm.
Does her star look like it's rising or falling? And I think that'll tell a lot about how the Kremlin wants to handle this. Interestingly enough, this is all happening as a wave of bomb threats are happening across Russia. It's separate from the letters that the Christian state has been sending to theaters threatening if they show this film. There have been just bomb threats across Russia that's causing a lot of chaos. There's all sorts of different versia in the Russian media about who's behind this, everything from the West to the Ukrainians. But some people are saying this is part of this as well. Mark, you wrote a piece for the Moscow Times that was published today that argued basically that this could really turn into a problem for Putin. It looks like he's not controlling the situation.
Well, this is it. I mean, because after all, Putin, so much of his legitimacy is Putin the security president, Putin the man who will keep your country safe. And there's always been a rally around the flag whenever we've actually seen terrorist attacks.
Real terrorism, yeah.
Now, I don't necessarily believe that there's any connection between these two.
Nor do I, but they're happening at the same time.
Exactly, but I think, again, and particularly in the context of this, undeclared but still already started political campaign, political season. In this context, because on the one hand, these cases, they are inconveniences, nothing else. No one is dying, thank God.
Yeah.
Well, and hopefully never. Uncharacteristic optimism there.
No,
but at the same time, I mean, exactly, because it doesn't have that kind of the cathartic theatre of a true terrorist attack, at which point Putin can come and say, we're going to find these people and we're going to deal with them, whack them in the outhouse and such like.
I knew you were going to say that.
Of course. instead, it's just about lots and lots of massive inconveniences against which the state doesn't seem to necessarily have much of an answer. And even if they catch people involved, and obviously they say they're about to, actually, we may well see waves of copycats and other people thinking, oh, actually, it's, you know, with internet telephony and so forth, it's easier than we thought. And this is all the kind of thing that, again, just speaks to this general degradation of the Kremlin's capacities. That, in fact, well, how far is the Kremlin really in charge? How far is the Kremlin really doing what we need it to do?
I mean, I know it. I mean, this is harder to directly link to it, but I think there is this sense in Russia, in the elite, and increasingly in the society, that Putin is becoming a lame duck. I mean, let's face it, his next term is probably going to be his last. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've written about this on the blog. And that's causing some turbulence, right? Tatiana Stanovaya had a great piece in Republik.ru where she was writing that the elite is acting as if the Putin post-Putin era is already beginning. Putin looks like a bystander in a lot of the intra-elite conflicts.
Yeah, and I think, honestly, I felt she kind of pushed that a little bit
she
further.
She did, but I had written something before this about the speculation about life after Putin.
Oh, that's a very
and
different
this is, and this is, but I think this is all part and parcel of this feeling, and the society may be beginning to feel this as well.
Well, I would say particularly, actually, if we loop this back to this kind of Christian state violence, I mean, part of these kind of violent acts, it's not just simply about one particular film. It's also about, an attempt to hijack the national agenda, mm-hmm. in a sense to define how Russia will develop. And, of course, that becomes more and more important if people feel that actually there will be a window of opportunity opening sooner rather than later, i.e. that Putin is not going to be there forever.
Anton, last words to you before we wrap it up for the week.
Well, I'll just probably add to your discussion that I do believe that inside Putin's regime, there is a competition between different groups. And if we agree to, or partly agree to, the thesis that post-Putin era is already starting, so we can place the developments with Poklonskaya, with this process around Matilda film in this context that one of the groups is trying to position itself and mobilize its own base. Mm-hmm. What this group, I don't know what this group is, but I don't believe that Poklonskaya alone with fellow protesters would be able to create such a turbulence. So one of the groups is trying to promote itself or strengthen itself by this process. So when the bargaining begins, this group would have some advantage.
Yeah, no, the Kremlin, as they say, has many towers. And to say the Kremlin is or isn't
also dungeon
involved behind in this is to say which tower are we talking about.
And that's a dungeon again.
Or a dungeon, or which dungeon. And on that happy note, we'll wrap it up for the week. That's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me in the studio has been co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, head of its Center for European Security, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And joining us via Skype from London has been Anton Shekhovtsov, a visiting fellow at the Institute for Human Sciences in Vienna, and author of the newly published and long-awaited book, Russia and the Western Far Right, Tango Noir. I got my copy, and I highly recommend that you all get yours. Thank you both for an interesting, enlightening, and lively discussion.
Pleasure.
Thank you, Brian.
And I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable colleague, Pavel Butorin, managing editor of RFRL's Russian language television program, Current Time, which you can watch at www.currenttime.tv. I'd also like to remind you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. I will be traveling for a couple of weeks to Washington, to Vilnius, and to Riga, and as a result, the Power Vertical podcast will not appear until October 6th. But until then, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.